Okay. Galo brought up the conference that we're going to be having in 2 weeks from now. Galo, do you want to tell us a little bit about the conference and how it's shaping up?
Well, we, as of just today, we have 113 people registered. That represents 82 grantees, 23 from EPA, mm-hmm. three PLC members, and then Mike and I and a couple others from HMTRI. The agenda, I've just started working on the agenda where I'm going to compile all the topics that all the people who registered sent in to me as topics that they want to talk about at the meeting. So the entire agenda is based on those topics. That process has just started. I work with EPA headquarters on that because there are several departments that want to attend on Monday evening session to
right.
give everyone an update on the different departments that are now involved in this project. So, yeah, it's shaping up really well. It's going to be a big meeting. It's going to be a good meeting. I don't know. What else do you want me to say about
now,
it, Mike?
The pretty much the registration's closed at this point for the workshop. Oh, is that correct?
Yeah, as far as us, I mean, we can take more registrations. It's mostly the hotel that's the problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
The group rate, our reserve block is now closed.
Mm-hmm.
We can get people in, the way I understand it, but their rate will be higher, and then they will be responsible for paying the difference between our group rate and whatever it is that the Hilton has available right now,
mm-hmm.
which I heard at last count was over 200. So
yeah.
it was a substantial difference in the group rate that we got.
Yeah. It's a little pricey, but too, for those of you on the PLC, and in just a second we'll introduce some people who have
Hello, can I ask you a question in terms of number of grantees attending? Were there any,
yeah.
Are they mostly new grantees or repeated grantees or those who are taking a year, 2 years off?
Oh, for the
or
most part, yeah, it's kind of a mixture of both. Well, all the ones that were awarded in 2011, all the new grantees have registered. People that were awarded last year have registered. And then there's people that have been coming to this forever that were awarded a long, long time ago. So it's a real mixture, which is what makes this meeting so good, because you have such a mixture of people, new people, with people who have been doing this for so many years that's why they learn so well from each other.
Right.
Well, we've got people like Glim, who is an old grantee.
Mm-hmm. Been around for a long time.
Right,
George, I think
George.
You've been to all these meetings,
yes,
haven't you?
Yes, I believe we have, yes.
Since 1998, he's been.
That's right. Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Seems like only yesterday.
I know.
Great,
yes.
It's a great experience.
Now, where's George coming from?
New Jersey.
New Jersey.
Oh, Missouri. Okay.
Yes.
Now, it's a great experience because we break into sessions. Now, actually, what we try to do on these professional learning community, these 30-minute calls every couple of weeks, is try to hit on some of the same topics that we address at the workshop. The workshop is face-to-face with all the grantees, and we get the benefit of having a lot of experienced people in the room and EPA people to answer our questions. So we do open it up to the PLC members. That's why we're talking about it now. Those of you who participate in the PLC, and we've got some people coming, are eligible to come. But you'll be in company with people who evaluate grants and who have grants, and we'll hopefully be controversial. If there's issues, we've expressed these issues in terms of extension of the grant time, extension of the dollar amounts, what are allowable costs, and of course we're going to be talking about all these issues today. We're going to talk about curriculum a little bit, but was there anyone who joined us that didn't announce themselves?
Yes, good morning. This is Jackie Bean and Gail Johnson with CSET in Visalia, California.
Great. We have a
I've got one more question about the conference. Did many people sign up for the OSHA training on Monday morning?
Oh, I'd say about half.
Okay. Good.
I haven't taken an exact count, but yeah,
right.
It's about half.
Okay, that's a good size group then.
Yeah, it is.
Yes.
That'll be an awareness training
yes.
in terms of the OSHA requirements. The EPA and the OSHA are so closely relinked because
mm-hmm.
you really can't do environmental cleanup without working with health and safety standards.
Right.
And this gets us into this whole area of curriculum development. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, the basic questions that we have to ask ourselves is, what should we be teaching in these training programs? Of course, how do we teach it? Where do we get qualified trainers to teach it? And then what about the unintended consequences of our training? And I don't know that we'll be able to hit all of those items today, but that's kind of what we'd like to talk about. And this whole issue of what should we teach is a tough one. This environmental, there's the whole area of the environmental part of this, and then the whole area of the cleanup of this, and they're all interlinked. And of course, the environmental, the cleanup, and doing this in a health and safety arena bring in several different agencies and a whole lot of courses. And I think maybe those of you who are in this know that you only have a certain number of hours of student eyeballs, and the trick is what do we teach and how do we develop our program? And of course, those of you who have been on these calls and when you follow these calls through the year, we spend a whole lot of time on needs assessment, and I apologize for being repetitive, but for those of you who hear this over and over, everything really depends on your needs assessment to determine. You kind of work backwards. What does your community need in terms of trained people? And you want to make sure that what you're training is what the community needs. And certainly the participants that you're going to be training will get jobs.
Al Dyson.
Hey, Al, how are you?
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. Anyone else join?
Yes, Myna Miller.
Okay. Okay, good.
Hi, Karen Sims, Grenada Karen. County Economic Development District.
Great. Now, do we have some people who are new grantees to the program online?
Yes.
Oh, great. Okay.
Yes, you do.
And you're coming to the workshop, I hope?
Yes.
Both of you, great.
Affirmative.
Great. We're talking about trying to decide what to teach, and, of course, those of you who have submitted grants or will be submitting grants know already determined what you're going to be teaching. If you are on a speakerphone, kind of, if you could mute your phone, that'd be great. How did George, for example, how did you determine what you were going to teach when your cadre of courses?
Well, initially, way back when, we put together an advisory committee composed of. We had the mayor of the local town. We had two owners of environmental companies. We had a chemical engineer on board who worked with EPA cleanups in New Jersey. And we sat down and asked what they looked for in an entry-level employee.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's how we got off the ground. Our main trainer has always been NJIT, New Jersey
mm-hmm.
Institute of Technology. And they have a seat on our advisory board also.
So you pretty much work backwards. You try to
yes.
find out from the community what kind of jobs are out there
mm-hmm.
at that time.
And yes. Yes.
And it sounds from following your program, that's actually changed. When weatherization became a hot issue,
mm-hmm.
you all got into weatherization.
Yes, we did. And we've had, over the years, we've had employers that when they go in and do a major cleanup, they also have the contract for the landscaping and the horticulture work. And we've incorporated that into a number of our training programs also, the forest landscape side of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we've had employers. We always have about 6 hours on this general preventative maintenance working on trucks and vehicles and equipment and how to check oil levels and fluid levels and tire pressures and just the very basics, just to prevent something from going wrong, the difference between the gasoline and diesel fuel and kerosene and different weights of oils. And
so actually, while when we think of an EPA training program,
yes,
we think of EPA courses, but then there's all these ancillary awareness courses that
yes.
to make your students marketable, you may have to give them training, whether it's commercial driver's license,
exactly. That,
CDL.
We have a segment on just basic electric arc welding and using torches. And,
mm-hmm.
and it's just they may not be experts at it. Well, they're not experts, but they are familiar with being
so
an environmental tech.
So
yes.
if they're doing deconstruction work, they may need those skills. The
sure,
same with
PPE.
Forklift driving or
yes.
even backhoe driving to some extent.
Exactly.
They
get used to wearing hard hats and safety glasses and
mm-hmm.
keeping track of their gloves.
Mm-hmm. Now, Tim, you all in St. Louis area pretty much went through the same process, didn't you?
Yeah, we had our advisory committee, and we pretty much looked at what we did in the past, what was successful, and then talked to the advisory committee and took recommendations from them,
mm-hmm.
and then just looked to see what we could put together.
Yeah. How is your direction of your program going or changed? Has it been migrating in different directions?
No, I mean, it's when we first started out, the weatherization piece wasn't, the training was fine, but the jobs really weren't out there. But it seems, 2 years
mm-hmm.
down the road, some weatherization jobs are starting to open up a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. And that's a good point. Weatherization was an interesting one because there was this promise of massive amounts of federal money coming into weatherization, and
yes.
A whole lot of training programs went into it, and then the rubber didn't meet the road, or
no.
there was a whole lot of training, and people had to pare back. And are you're now seeing weatherization come back a little bit? Or
we're seeing some weatherization jobs, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it also it could also have something to do with the fact that we got hit with some tornadoes pretty good and a lot of rain, so. And then the excessive heat, so people are taking a little bit more importance, should we say, to what they can do to help their energy cost.
Mm-hmm.
So can I ask you a question? So you were preparing people for weatherization jobs, and the jobs weren't there. So how did people migrate or transfer their skills into different type of jobs?
We part of our training is a weatherization piece.
Oh, that's just a small part of that. You turn
yeah.
out the skills beside that. Yeah, that makes sense.
I think that makes sense.
Yeah,
wisely, EPA, and because it's an EPA program, requires 1910-120, which is the HAZWOPR. And, of course, everyone that's got a training program, if they get federal money, and actually whether you don't get federal money, the 1910 makes one somewhat marketable in that he can go on a waste site. Where you cannot go on a waste site unless you have that certificate. So right off the bat, you've got one particular requirement that's fairly valuable.
Yes.
That RRMP can be valuable in some cases if you're in a urban area. RRMP is a lead painting and repair certification. And that may be, something that's of value to people.
Mm-hmm.
Do both of you teach the RRMP also?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
And right away, you're getting someone that's got a value added right off the bat. When we talk about asbestos, that's one that was one of those pollutants, and that was one that was fairly useful at one time. It's become
mm-hmm.
less important as time has gone on.
Yes.
Anyone doing asbestos out there?
Yes, we are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we do asbestos awareness right now, but
mm-hmm.
not the certificate.
And George, you brought up an interesting point.
Yes.
At the point at which it becomes from a front line, something that's very marketable and hot burner, you turn it more into awareness.
Yes.
So that you've got, and if we were to go through, if we look at the types of courses we might have, we got within EPA, we've got air, we've got water and wastewater, we've got
mm-hmm.
solid waste, we've got radiation. Somewhere in there would fit asbestos.
Yes.
So we've got these different media just within EPA. And within that, subcategories, we've got this whole area of assessment, which is determining what the pollution is. And these are all your courses that have to do with sampling, air monitoring, water monitoring,
mm-hmm.
radiation monitoring,
yes.
assessing waste sites. So you've got this whole subcategory amongst all these media of assessing and determining what the pollution is. And then you've got this whole other area of once it's assessed, how do you clean it up?
That's
and
right.
the cleanup part is what a lot of us think of these EPA jobs as. But there's a whole area of assessment, sampling analysis, the, doing test drill hole, drilling test wells, air monitoring, water sampling. So there is a whole field there. And then the whole area of cleanup, and this is where you bring in your OSHA courses. If we're talking about the cleanup, we might be involved in deconstruction, and we might be talking about tank removal, remodeling, where we're ripping out windows that have lead
mm-hmm.
paint, and you might have confined space. Interlinked with the cleanup are all the OSHA courses. If you're in a confined space, or you have to go into a tank, you're going to have a confined space OSHA course.
Yes.
If you're doing window replacement or deconstruction, you may need asbestos or lead,
mm-hmm.
That whole area. Disaster response, which is becoming now more and more interesting as a course because of all the number of disasters post-Katrina.
Yes.
And Tim, you hit it right on the head there when the tornadoes going through the Midwest now
mm-hmm.
are starting to rival Katrina in terms of, the,
yes.
the destruction that's going on. So you've got this whole area of these environmental courses that have to do with disaster response. And then, of course, we've got the whole area of energy, which is the weatherization courses, the alternative and clean fuels, types of courses.
Mm-hmm.
So there are just so many courses you can teach, and the question is how do you translate all of these courses into a core curriculum and then you pushing everything else into awareness type courses?
Mm-hmm.
And how do you all usually handle that? Do you pick out some stars and then just have some basic courses that do everything else?
I think this is George from New Jersey. I believe that's what we do. I mean, the OSHA 40, it will always be at the heart of our training.
Mm-hmm.
And then whatever the needs are of the employers, as well as trends and weatherization. We caught that wave very early on and invested about $2 million in training and tools and outfitting crews. And unfortunately, that wave never arrived. But we are ready for it. But we just cycled all of our weatherization people right into the brownfields job training.
Mm-hmm.
And that has really made them all that more marketable.
Mm-hmm.
The everything weatherization, the energy, the brownfields, the forestry, the landscaping, these are all green industry jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And they're prepared.
So you're basically giving people a series of mini certification.
Yes.
So that could prepare them for any field, really.
Yes. With the market the way it is, we feel that that's probably the best way to go at this time.
Yeah, I would.
So what
agree.
You want to do is allow them to put on their resumes when it's time to get the job that they've had some awareness training in
mm-hmm.
whether it's water, wastewater, or some sampling. They've done
yes.
sampling. For example,
sure,
they might go out and they find out, well, we don't have a weatherization job, but we're looking for someone to do water sampling.
Mm-hmm.
Can you do it, or have you ever done it? And, of course,
that's
if
right.
they've done it in class, they can talk the language, which
mm-hmm.
is often the most important part.
Yes.
As
Mike said, the site characterization and sampling, we'll cover that. Measurements and instrumentation. We'll probably have just about every instrument imaginable, the monitoring devices, combustion gas indicators, oxygen meters, flame ionization detectors, Geiger counters, pH measurements. Again, they'll not be experts, but they will be familiar with the instrument and in the process. And
right.
should they get on a job, it's not going to be the first time they saw it.
They know what XRF is.
Yes.
Do you teach them land surveying at all?
We have, we'll teach them how to use GPS.
Right.
In the mapping.
Right.
And that's about as far as, oh, you mean the surveying a site. Yes, of course we do that. I'm sorry,
yeah.
I'm thinking of transit, and that's not the type of surveying we're talking about. Sure, we'll do the site surveys and characterization. Yes.
Yeah.
Everything
and, of course, awareness of phase one and phase two and
yes.
how to do a phase one assessment. For those of you not familiar, it's basically a real estate search. And then when we go
yes.
into phase two, we're getting more into our sampling and analysis.
Yes, we'll talk about how to do it, you know, how to do a search and find the history of the property. And
right. Now, some
yes.
states do require a licensed land surveyor to
right.
be doing that. But even though states that require a licensed people, they do have assistant to do that kind of work as well that not necessarily have a license with them.
Mm-hmm. That's
there
true.
Are states that are requiring, you know, all real estate, commercial properties, to do phase ones at least, and that alone, if you're not a federally funded operation, and depending on your state laws, you may be able to set up a training program just showing people how to do phase ones for realtors. It in itself is a,
yes.
A valuable course to have. But George brought up an interesting point here, and he just rattled off an incredible amount of equipment and infrastructure
yes.
required to do this training. And it leads into the second question is, how do we teach and where do we teach this? And now you use a university.
We use
now, Tim, you also use a university, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, we use St. Louis University.
Mm-hmm. Some of you use community colleges. Anyone out there use community colleges? That's another source.
Mm-hmm.
Use them how? As in a partnership or for jobs? Or how exactly is that linked?
Well, with us, I'm with St. Louis Community College. We partner with St. Louis University. They do the actual training at the Center for Environmental Education and Training.
Right.
Okay.
When I was at the community-based organization, we would partner with a technical college so that they instead of investing, because the money you get from EPA is not enough to invest into equipment and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So partnering with a community college or any technical college is a partner that they do have, they can provide that training for you.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
And you don't have, I mean, you instead of purchasing an individual course, they can customize a course with the list of competencies that you request. That would be the best approach I've found.
So you actually included them in the grant as a partner.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Now,
let me expand on that a little bit. I think I hear what he said. But when you partner with the university, they don't turn around and actually try to charge you like $600 per student and all that, do they?
For us, it's already a negotiated price prior to.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
right.
So you negotiate like a fixed price for so many students.
No, and in fact, the university, they teach these, a lot of these competencies as standalone, classes. If somebody off the streets wanted to pay for it, they could. And it's probably three times more than what we're charged for the Brownfield program.
Okay, that's what I was getting at. Okay, so you guys negotiate a fee, like a set fee, and then if you have five students, it's already paid for.
Right. Ours is just a flat rate, whether we train one person or 100 people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
There are a lot of benefits that go along with either a community college or a university, and those are the indemnification, the insurance, and the health and safety issues.
That's right, and as well as their name on the certificate.
Right.
Right.
The problem you might have, and the other routes are university, community colleges, and we're not pushing them by any means, but you might use a consulting firm or a training firm or an independent contractor. Now, you have to be aware, though, if you use an independent person, someone who may be an expert, but is doing this on the side, is, okay, what about health and safety? What about insurance?
Mm-hmm.
What happens if someone does a fit test on something and they have a heart attack?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lawsuit. How does and you have to plan for the worst, even though you it may be very, very remote that this would happen.
Yes.
But it has happened.
Yes, it has.
And
well,
and
so the other nice thing is, I was going to interrupt, the other nice thing about using the university is that some of the employers locally, they'll send their own employees to this St. Louis University for their own training.
Mm-hmm.
So it's already, you know, it already has credibility built in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, we've done that. We always we have an annual 8-hour refresher also, which we built into the training, and we've invited people from firms that have hired our graduates. Now, if they need somebody that needs a refresher, they're welcome to sit in with our refresher, and that's worked out well. And as I look at our program, and we work through NJIT, but it is also through a private contractor who's a chemical engineer. We've worked with that consulting agency since 1998. When I look at our trainers are people from the consulting agency, but they're all also, every one of our trainers is an environmental tech, and who are out there actually doing the job just about every day of the week. So they're just great people to have around with our students. Many of the backgrounds are similar from where the instructors came from. And a number of our instructors have hired our graduates. So we always tell the students that, you know, do your best because you may not realize it, but you're going to a job interview during the training.
Interesting.
Yes.
So that trainer actually knows the best students in the class.
Yes, they truly do.
And has and when you think about it, what it costs to hire someone with these credentials is very expensive. And
mm-hmm.
you know, we look
yeah.
at it from one side that it's hard. We're trying to place these kids, and it's, you know, it's a job trying to
mm-hmm.
place them and find them jobs. But if you're on the other side of the fence, if you're on the buyer's market,
that's right.
There are a lot of people out there looking for jobs, but they just don't have the credentials.
That's right.
And this training.
Yeah,
there's
no, when I look at our young people are 18 to 25 that we train, and looking at just that Brownfield's job training, and we have other training programs too, but right now there's just not another training program that we can offer that can provide them the type of pay and benefits and long-term employment that Brownfields can.
Mm-hmm. And get linked up with one of these firms. So the summary of this is we want to give them some power courses that is going to they're going to have the specialty, which is basically 1910-120, and perhaps whether you're assessment-oriented or cleanup-oriented, you're going to have some core curriculum. But then you have to be very careful and thoroughly verse your students, depending on the area of the country you're in, so that they don't go into an interview and they're blindsided because they don't know what an XRF is, or they don't know what a mass spec is, or they don't know how to do a certain type of sampling. That
mm-hmm.
that if they bring this up in an interview, they say, "Oh, yeah, we did that in class, and I can do that." And
sure, we're familiar with that.
I might need some knowledge and job training, but
mm-hmm.
I'm familiar with that, you know, and I've
yes.
done laboratory safety and labeling and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yes, and we do coach them throughout the training.
Yeah, excellent. Well, we try to keep these down to 30 minutes, and we're about out of time for this call. The next one we're going to have, because in 2 weeks we're going to be at this will be the annual grantee conference. We're going to have it on the 31st of August, the next professional learning community call. That'll be August 31st.
Mm-hmm.
So, but what I'll do is send out some notes, as we usually do to everyone on the list. And if you have any comments or want to add anything, just send it out, and we'll share it with the entire group. And we'll do that. And those of you on the call who are going to be in Alexandria, on the 22nd, 23rd. Look forward to seeing you, and bring your questions and issues along with you. And everyone else, stay on the calls. Throughout the year, there will be another round of grant applications coming up, and it'll be time to start looking at how we want to structure our program and how we want to make it better, and we'll kind of go from there.
Hey, Mike, one thing about the notes that you send out. I just wanted to let everybody know that the notes from past sessions are always uploaded to the Brownfields Toolbox website, and that URL is Brownfields, Brownfields-toolbox, toolbox.org. And once you get to that homepage, there's tabs along the top. If you click on the one that says PLC Corner, then you will see that there are session notes for all of the sessions that we've had. So if ever you want to look at past session notes and what was talked about, you can always look there.
Good. And if you know anyone who wants to come on a call, they can just send us an email. My email is msenew@aol.com, and we'll get you on our participant list and join us for one of the sessions.
Very good.
So we'll talk to you all on the 31st, if not before.
Okay.
All right.
Have a great couple weeks. Okay.
Mike, Lou, Tim.